welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. Today's topic is war films, the aesthetics of war films, how they're made, and how they're analyzed. Thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. David LaRocca, editor of The Philosophy of War Films. Thank you for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
So first, how did you get into studying and editing a book on war films? And you can go as far back as you'd like.
Okay, yeah. I was thinking about what prompted this particular project, and I think it goes back to an interest I had in war photography. So I trained as a photographer and was fascinated by the ways in which war photographers and photojournalists were, you know, literally framing war in their images, and how this approach to depicting war seemed to call into question this odd juxtaposition of art and news. Mm-hmm. So where a documentary image might be said to convey some historical, temporal or spatial information, like this thing happened in this particular place, there was also an artistic element, even at the level of choosing to shoot in black and white as opposed to color. So I was looking at and thinking about work by Robert Capa, mm-hmm, from World War II, and Philip Jones Griffiths from Vietnam, and more recent photographers like James Noxvay and Susan Mizellis came to mind, because these are artists as photojournalists. Mm-hmm. Along the same line, so as I was working on these depictions of war photography, I encountered the work of Jeff Wall, a Canadian photographer, and in particular, an image that he created called Dead Troops Talk. And perhaps some of your listeners are familiar with the image. I don't mean to spoil it, but it's a fabrication, right? So it's a war photograph. It's a depiction of war, but it is staged. Mm-hmm. And this got me interested in what might be called realism in the depiction of war, and how, if you wanted to, you could essentially fake or fabricate the emotional intensity of a war scene. Mm-hmm. So that's some of the origin of my interest in war photography. But then later this evolved into interests in war documentary films. Mm-hmm. A couple that come to mind are Christian Frey's War Photographer from 2001, which is a feature portrait of James Noxvay. And in that film, there's a film camera, a video camera attached to Noxvay's own SLR. Mm-hmm. So we can watch him photograph. We see through, or nearly so, see through the lens, or just beside it. So we see how he frames shots and what he chooses to photograph. And that piqued my interest in, that famous notion of Cartier-Bresson's, the decisive moment. But in this particular case, the notion that, in essence, the war photojournalists can conjure or create that decisive moment, mm-hmm, by holding the shutter or, you know, waiting to release it. I could go on in terms of where this led me in terms of documentary film, but maybe you want to follow up on some of this photography or related material.
Well, it is interesting, but I do want to move towards to talk about the book specifically.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so I think the transition to the book came partly in thinking further about films by Werner Herzog. So he has a couple of films that come to mind. One is called Fata Morgana from 71, and a later film, Lessons of Darkness, from 95. And these two films, in their own way, become documentary portraits of wars. Mm-hmm. And like Jeff Wall, there are elements of fabrication in them. Sometimes it's chronology, so showing something or pretending that something came later than it in fact did. Mm-hmm. Other times there's just misinformation given. So that interested me about how you might have, in Herzog's case, films that are positioned kind of popularly as documentaries, but in fact are more like works of art that provoke thought because of the way they're put together. And then one last pair of Herzog works that pushed me further to think about this notion of the philosophy of war films is the pair entitled Little Dieter Needs to Fly from 1997 and a film called Rescue Dawn from 2006. So the film from 97 is a documentary. It's presented that way, and it stars the historical figure Dieter Dengler, the actual person. Mm-hmm. The Rescue Dawn film from 2006 is a feature film starring the actor Christian Bale, and it is a dramatic, fictionalized retelling of Dieter's story. So this, again, was piqued my interest in the interaction between documentary and feature, fiction feature, and the ways in which, although they're telling, as it were, the same story, the means by which they tell it is very different. This got me into a deep well of a very interesting reading about film and representation on film, but particularly with respect to war and this the wide range of war from military campaigns all the way through surveillance and cyber terrorism and all manner of things. So what I was reading, the people I was reading at this time were people like Frederick Jameson on war and representation, Garrett Stewart, who has written extensively on film and medium and mediation. Robert Pippin has written on the Western and the nature of political thought in Hollywood Westerns. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Bronfen on films like All Quiet on the Western Front. Stacey Peebles on Iraq. Andrew Fiala on just war theory and the ethics of war. Mm-hmm. And lastly, Robert Burgoyne on the relationship between history and filmic depictions of historical events. Mm-hmm. So what happened was I was reading in all of these people on these particular topics, and then as the project was coming into focus, I reached out to them to contribute material, new material on films that were catching their attention, that perhaps were part of their ongoing research, and in particular try to focalize on what we're calling in this volume the philosophy of war films, mm-hmm. which I can get to if you'd like, you know, what would that mean? What is the philosophy of war films? So those people who I mentioned are all featured in the book, mm-hmm. As well as a handful of others.
So, yeah, I was going to ask how do you break that? The book is in four parts. How did you choose the four different sort of themes you explore then within that, the philosophy of war idea?
Yeah. So when I think of philosophy or an approach to something that's philosophical, there are definitely methodological approaches that we can talk about, but there's usually a kind of subject basis that one thinks of. So, for example, in part one, the aesthetics of war. Aesthetics is typically a subcomponent of the philosophy of value or value theory. Mm-hmm. So what else would appear there is ethics. So ethics and aesthetics often go hand in hand as part of value theory. In part one, we look at the relationship between the way things look and sound on film with what we think we're seeing and hearing. So this is, you might say, a return to these basic notions of information versus distortion or artistic expression. And the writers address those kinds of questions. In the next part, the interest is quite focused on the nature of the self, the individual, in particular, but also how when we speak of the self, we're also speaking of bodies, human bodies that are in war. Mm-hmm. And in this section, the concern is that it's one thing to say, let's say you've gone on a trip, you know, a vacation. You say, I went on this trip. But there's less of a, especially when it comes to memory, there's less of a concern with what the body did and more a question of what the mind remembers. Mm-hmm. And some of that can be somatic in nature. You can remember temperature or taste or elements of the environment. But again, it sort of shifts into a very cognitive space. And one of the things that's quite fascinating about war as a phenomenon is how embodied it is. And what we were interested in the second part was how that embodiment shows up on screen, where in effect we as viewers are unable to make contact with those bodies. So one of the concerns that we would have is that we're very regularly shown war films that feature tremendous amounts of casualties. The shock and gore of it all. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to come to terms with the actual reality-based, you might say, effects of this. So this can also be especially trying when you watch a documentary, because you've switched out of that mode where you're saying, oh, it's just a set. These are just actors pretending to die. Mm-hmm. You've moved into this footage is presenting me with a world in which these people have been injured or these people have died. And so we as viewers and listeners are making what feels like contact, kind of visual sonic contact with bodies that at the same time, once you turn the screen off and turn the sound off, they're not there anymore. Mm-hmm. So that was the concern of the second part. The third part is focused on, you might say, ethical theory as it interacts with not just the management and the prosecution of war, but also the ethics of depicting war. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one provocative statement would be all war films are anti-war films, mm-hmm. which one probably means something like, well, if you've seen a war film, then you probably don't want wars to happen because it's so awful. Mm-hmm. At the same time, a lot of war films can be presented as invitations for more war. They glorify patriotism, heroism. They depict the enemy as an object of hatred, or, you know, being worthy of being despised. Mm-hmm. So in those ways, they don't read as anti-war films. They read as invitations or excuses for war. So that takes us into the question of the ethics of having war films at all. Mm-hmm. What is it that they do? What are they for? Mm-hmm. And then the last part takes us into what philosophers would probably call metaphysics, that is the way in which war shapes reality, both personally for an individual soldier, but also culturally. You know, in what sense does World War II exist for us today? It's a construct, it's a mental construct that deeply, at the same time, deeply informs the shape of our reality, of political institutions, of international relationships. Mm-hmm. And so although it's far in the historical past, it's also very, very immediate and present, from everything from the way we speak about what happened to the legacy of various effects of the war. And in this last section, we try to take on fairly grand notions, including the way in which war always takes place in nature. I mean, it can't help but do this. I suppose when we start talking about intergalactic warfare or something, mm-hmm. or science fiction warfare, we may depart. But when we speak of just terrestrial war, the kind that's fought at sea and land and air, we are encountering the scene of war within nature as an ongoing process. So, in fact, the cover of the book is a still that reflects this. It's from the Thin Red Line, and you see that a railroad has been laid through a jungle, mm-hmm. and there are soldiers and other people gathered. So there's a sense in which war is being imposed on a natural environment, and this also becomes a point for reflection, right? How does a soldier relate to the brutality of war on the one hand, but also the difficulty of trying to survive in nature? For example, in Vietnam, many Vietnam films try to give some sense of how physically demanding the natural environment was.
Mm-hmm. So the things you've said, so there are two initial questions I have. The first is sort of about the viewers, maybe two parts to that. One is that I think I don't think any movie can be fully anti or pro war. I think it's up to the viewer when they approach it, what they take away from it. If they like war, they're probably going to take the stuff they like from the movie or the show or whatever. If they're against it, I think they'll take away those elements. And then also I think, then you have viewers who have experienced war versus viewers who have not experienced war. And it's interesting to me, you know, who is a movie really being made for in that regard? Obviously, the filmmaker wants to have as wide as an audience as possible. But it feels like those two types of audience members are going to take away different things. So I'm just curious if you could comment on that.
Yeah, to take your second point first, this is something I address in the introduction to the book, because I'm interested in precisely the question you ask. I guess you'd say, who are these movies for, and also what are they for? So for those who are not veterans, who haven't had any kind of military service, one of the things that I suggest or postulate in the introduction is the idea that for many people, in fact, for most people, war films simply are what war is. So whatever visual and sonic content, whether it comes from a documentary or a fiction film, whatever people see is in total, you might call it a person's war experience. Mm-hmm. So if they've tended to watch, historical documentaries with lots of footage from the front, that's going to shape their understanding of a historical event. If, on the other hand, let's say you're interested in ancient warfare, mm-hmm. and you don't have access to documentary footage, then you're going to be relegated to these reenactments and recreations and fabrications of the past. So I'm quite interested in this as a psychological point, which would fall in philosophical terms into questions about personal identity, about the nature of judgment, and what one believes is valuable in terms of, you know, human dignity, you might say. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's as it were, an answer that will get us out of this question. It does feel more like an open question. Mm-hmm. I think that you notice the tension in the question when you have debates between the so-called people who were there, you know, people who were on the front versus people who are watching. I remember this came up, repeatedly with Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan and the opening sequence on Omaha Beach, that veterans were attesting to the ways in which Spielberg had captured what it felt like. So there are these moments where those who maybe weren't even born, much less who couldn't be there, and those who were there, share a text, and perhaps the film itself mediates that history, and it says, this is as close as we're going to get. So if this is the memory that we're going to have of this event, this is probably the one we should go for. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could return to your first question, which is about how we are seeing war films from our particular point of view, which would include values, ethical values, but also political values, mm-hmm. aesthetic perspective. For example, one person may think that a film is not well told, even if the, you know, the story itself is not very compelling, while the imagery is quite convincing, or, you know, has a great impact. So there, it's not necessarily the case that great representations of war fall always into coherent narratives or narratives that are full of facts and truths. Mm-hmm.
So going back to your Private Ryan example, I think there's a danger in something where, you know, you have veterans saying, yes, this is how it was, or this is as close as it gets. And then everyone marching with that idea and saying, okay, this is, we found as close to the truth as we can get. Because it's still a bunch of scenes from various viewpoints. You can't really represent how it feels to be the one person among many dying, and just being within yourself. It still has its limitations, and then it becomes dangerous where everyone from this point on says, okay, that's the definitive truth, because you can't know that it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you've really isolated a crucial point that I agree with. What we might say, and you know, we want to be fair to, you might say, the perspective. I want to respect the perspective of someone who says that's what it felt like. Mm-hmm. But it also, the word that comes to mind, and I don't mean it as an offense, but there's a certain naive reading of film as a medium, mm-hmm. right? A sense that somehow there's this phrase that it was like we were there. You know, there's this notion of immediacy, mm-hmm. that Janusz Kaminski managed to achieve, that's the cinematographer for Spielberg. And yet, you know, there's an apocryphal comment, where they're trying to figure out how to replicate the look and feel of Omaha Beach and the tumult of the invasion. Mm-hmm. And Kaminski says, hit the camera. So you have it actually being physically impacted by hands or some other means to replicate explosions or impacts and so on. So there's a very rudimentary, you might say, special effects happening there, as opposed, you know, in-camera special effects. Mm-hmm. Another, I think, crucial anecdote also comes from Omaha Beach, and this takes us back to Robert Capa's photographs. So we know that Capa was on the beach that day photographing with a rangefinder of some sort. He sent the images to a lab that, from what I've learned, overheated them, basically melted them. And the sort of smeared and striated look of many of these images from Omaha Beach are the look is due mostly to heat damage. It's not due to the focus or even the impact of anything on the camera, or for that matter, where Capa pointed his camera. Mm-hmm. And that kind of the graininess and the almost the atmosphere of the images is an accident of post-production, of, you know, the lab. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right on target to point out that for those who want to speak about the proximity to a real event, there's always going to have to be some skepticism left for the way in which media, whether it's film or sound, whether it's done with actors or with historical figures, is going to be in between us and that event.
Mm-hmm. And this brings up another question or maybe issue I have with the aesthetics of war films, which is that, and again, we can take Private Ryan, but also other films that are based on true events, whether they're war or crime or what have you. They need drama to drive the story. So you have characters who are maybe more emotional or argumentative than they were in real life. You have war situations where they show more troops than maybe there were. There's more density of action as compared to maybe the real situation. And I think the problem there is it obscures sort of the slow, quiet creep of death in war situations where things move much more slowly and less obviously and still result in, you know, the dismemberment and death of people. So I feel like there's a danger in presenting war as something that's, the danger is obvious and you'll see it and you'll be able to react to it when it comes. Whereas the truth is things are much quieter and you can still have extreme situations result. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. It's a very important point. This notion of how we have come to rely on film to present us with not just a story, but a story told with a certain rhythm and intensity. And if you look at the history of war films, and this is something that this book tries to do, where the authors are looking back as far as Charlie Chaplin films, for a film from 1918, all the way through Zero Dark Thirty, just a few years ago. The idea is that we have been habituated to a certain recipe or structure for a war film, and when films deviate from that, they run the risk of disappointing audience members or critics. At the same time, they could open up new vistas and new insights, and for that reason are praised. So one example that comes to mind as an example of a deviant form, but in a good way, is the film The Messenger by Oren Moverman. Mm-hmm. And this is about the way I describe this is as a home front war film. So we never see any overseas battle or barracks or anything like that. We hear about it. We hear about someone who was in a firefight and so on. But mostly what we're experiencing is an encounter with two soldiers who are now on the home front, and they're delivering news to the next of kin, the news being that your son or daughter or spouse has been killed in the line of duty and in action. And this is not only an unusual topic for a war film to undertake, but it's also told and it's filmed in surprising ways. One example being the pacing of things. It's a slower, quieter, I'm trying to tap into your point about the lived time of war, mm-hmm. the way in which time in a, you know, waiting for the next deployment could be weeks or months if you're on the home front, or when you're out in the field, you may be also waiting for action, and then action happens and it's very quick and it's over. So, for example, there's one scene in the middle of the film The Messenger that's a long take, and if I remember, it's about 9 minutes long, and it's the soldier and a woman in a kitchen, and the shot is held for about 9 minutes, and it's almost wordless. Mm-hmm. And it's just studying the ways in which they're looking at one another and moving and interacting with the environment. But it stands out because it's not the sort of thing we're used to seeing in a war film. Mm-hmm. We're used to the frenetic movement from one battle scene to the next, or one set of crises and controversies, maybe in various chains of command or something like this. So, mm-hmm.
Do you think as fewer and fewer Americans and let's say Europeans too are involved with the military directly or have friends and family who are in the military, as you have a smaller population of veterans and sort of their support, let's say, do you think films, war films, are becoming more disengaged from the actual participants in war and are the audience is more, they're serving the audience that wants to know and doesn't really know the truth and has sort of preconceived conceptions about war? And I don't want to weigh this question too much either way. It sounds like I am, but do you have a response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it matters. I believe the director of The Messenger is a veteran. I think he served in the Israeli army. And it's those kinds of elements of production that I find interesting, whether there's something that he's bringing to the production that's a virtue, basically, of his experience. Mm-hmm. I think that one war in particular comes to mind, and that is Vietnam, where you have a draft, mm-hmm. and you're operating really in a, and I mean, of course, World War II did as well. But the point being that in terms of contemporary war, we haven't had the draft since Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I wonder about the ways in which Vietnam War films and also Vietnam War documentaries, say Ken Burns' recently released multi-part documentary, mm-hmm. the way in which those documents, whether they're fiction or documentaries, are highly contested, partly because you have a group of people who were drafted, mm-hmm. who did not seek out the soldiering life, mm-hmm. as their vocation.
Right.
They're sort of plucked from the civilian life and put into war, and how that has shaped the kinds of stories that are told. And similarly, I think for World War II films, that the draft is this interesting element about the nature of depiction and how stories get told. Whereas if you look at later, say, films from the Gulf War to the present, you have much more of an ethic of people volunteering, first of all, mm-hmm. and then a question of things like, what are the reasons for volunteering? So we've already shifted away from being conscripted to volunteer, but for example, you'll have people volunteer for a job, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're doing it to pay for college, or they're doing it as a way to train in some field, like engineering or computer science or something. Mm-hmm. And then there are the sort of mercenary types, those who want to fight and want to serve, but that's their goal. And then maybe we have another category of people who are drawn by some kind of ethical impulse to right or wrong. What comes to mind here is the way in which American Sniper was presented, mm-hmm. that this is a story of someone who is angry and upset about harm done to the United States and wants to go seek out to defend and to destroy accordingly. So I guess the way I'm trying to answer this is by saying that I do think that we go through generations where it's the role played by the ways in which people get into wars is going to affect the ways in which they speak about the films that represent them. Mm-hmm. If I try to bring it right to the latest incarnation of this, we're beginning to see films that show people at computer terminals. Mm-hmm. And they're, for the most part, they're operating drones or surveillance cameras or something like this. Mm-hmm. And they may be killing at a great distance, right? From Nevada to unleashing ordnance in the Middle East or something. Mm-hmm. And this is, to me, yet another version of the way in which the people that you're talking about, the soldiers who are enlisted, are going to come to terms with how they are represented. And we could also talk about the emergence of augmented reality, virtual reality, and video games.
Yeah. I'll just make a quick point. As far as what you said about the draft and stuff, I do think that you had a wider range, maybe a bigger, more truthfulness among, you know, these draftees included, writers, natural filmmakers, that sort of thing, people who didn't want to be there but were there and had the voice. Whereas now you have a more homogenous outlook among volunteers. So I wonder if in our current wars, the most creative voices might be the war journalists, the people who, you know, are perhaps, you know, more inclined, they're more creative. I don't want to say that people who enlist or volunteer aren't creative, but you just have a smaller pool as compared to the past. So maybe wartime journalists, it feels like they're the current storytellers who, you know, their works are made into the movies and whatnot. You know, of course, the American Sniper is an exception and a few others, but that seems to be the predominant storyteller right now. That's just the impression I get.
Yeah. No, I think that there's a lot of history to be mined about the interaction between those who make the movies and those who are, as it were, undergoing the war experience. So, you know, if you look back to World War II, the government enlisted some of the biggest names in Hollywood, Frank Capra, John Ford, George Stevens, John Huston. There were tremendous talent, people who were going and leaving their Hollywood work essentially to go to the front. George Stevens comes to mind because before the war he was known for producing comedies, light fare, what we might today call romantic comedies, this sort of thing. And he volunteered, he was asked, of course, but he went to Europe, and he was part of the group that was liberating concentration camps. And he was filming in these liberated camps, and it changed him utterly. Mm-hmm. And his film he never returned to comedy, as it were. His films became much more serious. Mm-hmm. And the war clearly had an effect on him. So there's that, those kinds of cases. And you're bringing up war journalism as a really crucial element to where it interacts with technology. So now that war journalists are able to film and live stream and, as it said, you know, embed themselves in a much different way than was possible generations ago, you see that the storytelling changes also. Mm-hmm. So one example that comes to mind is the remarkable documentary called Restrepo by Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger. Mm-hmm. And Hetherington, in fact, died as a war journalist a few years ago while in the line of serving as a war journalist. But this documentary is sort of the epitome of embeddedness and living among the soldiers and trying to come as close to being one of them without actually firing a weapon. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But even then, those stories are edited, you know, where you go past points of quiet and slowness, and you hit marks of dramatic action. So again, you know, I guess, I don't know how you're going to capture, you know, the slowness of war. But I still think there's a danger where people who haven't been in war think they know war based on these sorts of, you know, these works of art.
Yeah, and I think it can be helpful to remember, if we just compare war films generically with any other genre, you're going to find a similar kind of temporal collapse. Mm-hmm. So if I just mentioned romantic comedies, you know, think of the amount of screen time or elapsed time that we're thinking about from when a couple meets for the first time, and then, you know, let's say they, at the end, there's a wedding. Now, you know, screen time, we're talking about 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. So clearly there's been this huge evacuation of time, even though you can have things in the film that suggest time's passage. Mm-hmm. We don't actually want to sit around for weeks on end waiting for the phone to ring. Mm-hmm. So I think that film has its own way of dropping out what we might call lived time, or that sense of durational time that is long, and part of the you might say the psychology of war as well, the ways in which we experience it. You know, let's say you're in a prisoner of war camp, mm-hmm. right? You have been disabled from fighting. You are now, you've entered this space of, an unknown duration. You may die in prison, or you may be released, but that, again, how do you convey that on film? Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that that comes up in the two films I mentioned earlier, Little Dieter Needs to Fly and Rescue Dawn. Mm-hmm. You know, prisoner of war subgenre is perhaps an interesting area to think about the distortions of time as they're seen on screen.
So I would say that, yes, I agree with you. However, like, say, a romantic comedy, most people are familiar with how romance works. You know, they've lived through it, weddings, you know, and that. So when they see these dramatic points, they know, they realize that the quiet spaces in between that exist. However, with war films, and I press this point because war films often try or do shape people's political beliefs and how they approach such an important topic. So I think with war films, people who aren't familiar with it will miss the in-between points, between dramatic, you know, these dramatic marks.
That's a very astute point, that we essentially, those who haven't served, lack a frame of reference. Mm-hmm. And in effect, our only frame of reference is other war films.
Right.
It's a very troubling situation. Yeah.
I would actually argue that miniseries are maybe a better way to portray war fiction than films. You know, say, I forget the HBO one.
The Pacific or Band of Brothers?
No, the one about the recent Iraq war.
Generation Kill?
Right. So, and not that those capture it perfectly either, but I feel like when you stretch it out and you have more time to tell the story, you get a more authentic or honest narrative. Mm-hmm.
This is something that comes up too in the course of the book, which is the nature of serializing films, and miniseries or limited series are an interesting question. Does something else happen when you have 10 to tell a story? And that may be one of the benefits you're just pointing out now, is a more coherent representation of the passage of time, mm-hmm. just simply because you have more of it to use.
And so that actually, we can turn to video games, which I think video games, in a sense, are able to portray a more realistic view too, because people invest dozens of hours of play time, or, you know, days, weeks, months at a game, you know, and often these games have a lot of slow periods. Again, I'm not going to say video games are an accurate portrayal of war, but perhaps they get closer, you know, to the carnage. You mentioned movies don't show a lot of carnage. I feel like video games will show much more carnage and will show a more, I hesitate to say realistic, but, you know, closer to reality maybe than films.
Hmm. Well, the thing that has really drawn my attention to video games is the way in which what's called first-person shooter point of view, so FPS, or what filmmakers often just call POV, the point of view.
Right.
It's that sensation of looking at a screen and it essentially being your field of vision. And you get this in fiction films a lot when they're trying to dramatize, let's say, a soldier who's caught in a crossfire.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll have the camera turn as if it were a head turning, and it feels like, oh, I'm in the battle. The bullets are coming at me, and by me, we mean the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So with video games and this, you know, the advances in AR and VR, I think that this, you know, as you're alluding to, this intensification of where the viewer slash player is becoming more complicated, and it really can capture some of the issue of time you're bringing up about duration.
Mm-hmm.
So if you need to take more time in a video game, you can. I imagine that there are consequences for that because you're supposed to achieve something in a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that sort of durational standing, breathing, looking around, searching, those kinds of things that are all done in a POV kind of way are often not things that we see in the tableau style of war films, where it's a huge platoon approaching another in a forest or something.
Mm-hmm.
There just isn't that element. And then, of course, the obvious and most striking difference is this somatic embodied sense of actually firing the weapon. So this is also a completely radical departure from the spectator model of war films,
mm-hmm.
where we are a witness to these terrible things as opposed to perhaps a perpetrator of them. And as video games become more realistic or hyperreal or surreal, there's lots of variations on this. The question I've been thinking is, will this perhaps have some kind of latent effect on people?
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a lot of debate, and I've been trying to follow some of it, about actual psychological impact of playing war video games. Everything from heightened aggression to other forms of behavioral difficulty, depression, anxiety,
mm-hmm.
Paranoia, psychotic episodes, and so on. So time will tell. I think we're still at the very early stages of the technology, but one can imagine in the decades to come, the technology will advance.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to the research that was done for the book by the different authors. How do the authors of the various articles, how do they immerse themselves in this subject? What fields of academic study do they involve themselves in? Does that make sense?
You know, yes, very much so. So one of the things that I was hoping to achieve, and hopefully the book attests to this, is a great variety of scholarly areas and different disciplinary approaches. And you have, for example, cultural critics and theorists. You have English professors, philosophers, media studies people, political theorists,
mm-hmm.
Literary critics, historians, poets, what else? Ethicists. Right, there's a great range. And in addition to that, all of the people and all of the disciplines I just mentioned, all these scholars are coming from a great depth of knowledge about war films. They've almost all published something significant on war films in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to know their work, in effect, was by reading their earlier things. Mm-hmm. So what's happening here is they're building on prior research, and they're, in some cases, taking on new films that that relate to their interests. Mm-hmm. In other cases, they're returning to films and enriching their past reflections. Mm-hmm. And there's also a diversity of the kinds of films. So everything, as I mentioned, from Charlie Chaplin to Iraq war films, from a documentary that's a kind of autobiography, and this is Ross Nickleby's Sherman's March, mm-hmm. to thinking about Westerns and samurai films, mm-hmm. World War II films, and Europe and other European films, like films that take place in Israel. Mm-hmm. So the attempt here is to present a wide variety of disciplinary subject matter and approaches to a shared topic.
Mm-hmm. So during the editing work, what did you come across that was most surprising to you?
I think the thing that we actually were discussing just a moment ago, this the way in which we're watching film and media-based technologies evolve over time. So if we go back to early 20th century and how wars are depicted, you know, we're in this, say, the first phase of film as medium, and that is celluloid, and it's black and white. And what became surprising to me is when you read the book through, when you sort of read it from front to back, what you find is that there's a shared preoccupation with the way in which the actual media technology is informing the meaning or the representation of war. Mm-hmm. So if the war doesn't have color, that's one thing. Or if the war is shot in Panavision versus in a square format. And you can go through, through time, including things that might not at first glance seem that significant, but editorial styles. So the way in which a film is cut, is it cut in a frenetic way? Is it assembled in a kind of montage where images are juxtaposed and they're meant to generate meaning? Is it slow and quiet and full of long takes? Those also are related to medium. And I think that with all of these philosophical preoccupations, like the aesthetics, the ethics, the metaphysical, we see how technologies affect our reading of all of these things. Mm-hmm. As we move now into films that are fully digital, in many cases recorded in 3D, and then pushing even further into the VR and the AR, where we may get to a point where we're in a kind of immersive environment where we can look in a 360 degree panoramic, like space, and find ourselves either, you know, you can imagine being set up as a soldier, mm-hmm. with a full equipment and a gun in hand and a helmet, but you could also imagine being, some bystander in a war-torn region, mm-hmm. and your goal is to hide or duck and cover. And, you know, are there reasons to use these for educational purposes? Would these be useful for soldiers in training to have a sense of what it's like to face a person coming at them, you know, who's in full military equipment, and would that change their response to the unarmed civilians they see? You know, these sorts of reversals. There's lots of potential there for how war and representation continue to interact. So I think that's what's been most surprising, and it has also left the project very much open-ended for me. Mm-hmm. I continue to write about these things and have been working on this sort of next phase of the ways in which technology is influencing our thoughts about the representation of war.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope the book will do?
Well, now that it's in paperback, I hope it will find its way to more readers. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the main inspiration for the book is really to generate thoughtful conversation about war films. Mm-hmm. And having some orientation in the history of philosophy, I think, can be quite helpful because it provides a language that people can borrow and make their own. Mm-hmm. And help them articulate what they think about war films that have been made, but also as they emerge, this could become a bit of a companion for those who like to watch war films or who like to compare war films with other films. In the introduction, for example, I point out the ways in which there are other genres that often will borrow war as a framing device. So it will be a dramatic love story, but it will take place with war kind of at the edge or the periphery of the film. And there's something about the gravity of that, the intensity, the sense of danger and risk that prevails. And yet really what you're watching is a love story.
Mm-hmm.
So, as one becomes attuned to war films and the traits that are most common, hopefully there's just that sense of a greater literacy, an ability to say what's working and what's not and why that's important.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure when the hard cover came out, but can you discuss any issues you had finishing or getting the book published and how you overcame those?
The hardback came out in 2014, and the paperback was just released this month in 2018. Mm-hmm. So I'm very fortunate to be involved with this series that is edited. The series editor, Mark Connard. Mm-hmm. It's called The Philosophy of Popular Culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the war films book is the second of three books I have in the series. I also have a book on Charlie Kaufman,
mm-hmm.
and more recently a book on the philosophy of documentary film. And so in terms of finding a home for this work, I felt very fortunate that the editor, the series editor, as well as the publisher were very receptive to this subject. Mm-hmm. And the university Press of Kentucky, which published this film, also has a very strong library of books about war and film and history.
Mm-hmm.
So this fit nicely into their one of their strong portions of their list.
Mm-hmm. So you touched on some of what you're studying now. What's your next? What do you think your next writing project will be? What do you think you'll have coming out next?
For editing. It looks like the next project will involve further work on the philosopher Stanley Cavell,
mm-hmm.
who died this summer, and now whose work is transitioning now into assessing his legacy in a different way. So that's where my thoughts are these days.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where can people find the books you've worked on and also your thoughts? Do you have social media presence?
Well, in terms of finding me, the easiest way is just myname.org, so davidlaraca.org,
mm-hmm.
and there's various contact information. I don't have any social media presence.
Mm-hmm. But you do have the website, so that's...
I do have the website, yeah. So if that counts, then
yeah,
there it is. And there's lots of information about my other work as well as a way to contact me directly, email address. So.
Okay. So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
just to thank you for your interest and your time, and to reach out to the audience who's also shared this time with us. I really appreciate your attention. Thank you.
All right, cool. Well, thank you. This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.